Okay, so let's get into this. We're hearing the headlines, everywhere right now. This nuclear renaissance, governments, tech companies, it feels like everyone is suddenly looking at nuclear power again to hit those zero carbon targets. But there's this massive kind of silent engineering challenge that's lurking behind all those shiny press
It
releases.
really is. It's the difference between, say, drawing a blueprint and actually keeping a machine running for, what, half a century? And it's not just about building new plants. The real pressure, I think, is on the existing fleet.
Because the whole idea is to take reactors that were designed back in the 70s, maybe the 80s, for a 40-year lifespan and push them to 60.
That's a huge jump.
It's a 50% extension. And from the research you brought to the table today, it sounds like you can swap out almost every single part of a nuclear plant to make that happen, except for one.
The reactor pressure vessel, the RPV.
The unmovable object.
Exactly. If the fuel is the heart, the RPV is the body. It contains everything: the core, the coolant, the extreme pressure, the
It's
radiation.
the ultimate life-limiting component.
Yes, you generally cannot replace it. So if the steel in that RPV fails, the plant is just, it's done. Game over.
So today we are doing a deep dive into exactly what keeps that steel from failing. We're basing this on a PhD thesis by Hector Pios Romero from the University of Cambridge.
A great piece of work.
And I have to say, reading through it, it struck me that this isn't just about, making steel. This is about a whole transition in human knowledge,
How so?
moving from, well, we do this because it worked last time, to we know exactly what every single atom is doing.
That is the crux of it. It's the
Yeah.
shift from empirical metallurgy, which is basically just high-stakes trial and error, to a quantitative understanding.
Right.
And Romero's work focuses on one specific alloy, SA508 grade 3. It's the industry standard for these vessels. And as we'll see, keeping this steel safe for 60 years, it requires winning a battle that's fought at the level of nanometers.
Before we get down to the atoms, though, we really have to respect the scale of this thing.
Oh, absolutely.
I was looking at the dimensions you pointed out in the thesis, specifically from the Kashiwazaki Kariwa plant in Japan. And these numbers, they're just hard to process.
It is a true behemoth. You're looking at a single cylinder of steel that is roughly 7 meters in diameter
7 meters.
and weighs about 900 tons.
900 tons. That is, what is that? That's like stacking 500 cars on top of each other into a single piece of metal.
Give or take, yeah. And that scale creates immediate problems. You can't just pour hot liquid metal into a mold that big and expect it to be, perfect.
Physics gets in the way.
Physics starts to work against you.
And this is that macro segregation issue, right? It sounds like a sociology term, but I'm guessing it's not.
Very different context, yes. Think about a massive vat of soup cooling down. If it takes days or even weeks to cool, which a 500-ton ingot does, the ingredients start to separate as the steel solidifies the carbon and the
The
impurities.
stuff you don't want.
The stuff you don't want concentrated, yeah. It tends to drift toward the center and to the top.
So you end up with this chemical imbalance. The center of the ingot has a completely different makeup than the outside. That sounds a total nightmare for quality control.
It is a disaster for predictability. You need that steel to be uniform. So the industry uses a technique called the hollow ingot process, or they use something called trepanning.
Trepanning. That sounds like some kind of evil medical procedure.
Well, it's actually pretty similar. They literally core the ingot like an apple.
No
They
way.
remove the center entirely.
They just throw the middle away.
They recycle it, but yes, for the vessel itself, they discard the core. That's where the worst segregation and what's called shrinkage porosity live.
That's the little
The
void.
little voids that form when the metal contracts. You just want that clean donut of steel that's left over.
Okay, so we have a 500-ton donut. But we don't just machine that into a shape. We have to beat it up first. This section of the notes was wild. I'm calling it extreme blacksmithing.
It is blacksmithing, just for giants. You have to forge it.
Why?
The ass cast structure, so how the crystals form when they first freeze, it's way too coarse, it's weak, and there are still tiny microscopic holes inside it.
And you need to crush those shut.
You need to crush them shut. The thesis mentioned that 75% reduction ratio.
What's that?
You have to squash the metal down to a quarter of its original thickness. That's the only way to guarantee those internal voids are welded shut just by the pressure.
And the terms for these steps were just fantastic. Cogging, becking, upsetting. It felt like I was reading a manual from like the 1800s.
They're old terms for a modern application. So cogging is pressing the ingot along its length to to consolidate the center. Upsetting, which isn't emotional distress in this case,
right,
is compressing the cylinder end to end to make it shorter and fatter.
So it basically turns a tube into a really thick ring.
Exactly. And becking is where they put a massive bar through the hole, a mandrel, and then they hammer the ring against it to thin the walls and expand the diameter.
It's violent.
It's incredibly violent, but it's necessary. It breaks up those coarse crystals, and it prepares the metal for the most critical phase, the recipe.
The heat treatment. And this is where Romero's thesis really starts to challenge the conventional wisdom, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Because up until now, we're just shaping the clay. Now we're baking the pot.
And just like baking, the temperature and the timing, they change everything.
Yeah.
The goal here is to set the microstructure. You want a steel that is strong so it holds the pressure.
Right.
But also tough so it won't crack if it gets hit or stressed.
But there's a trade-off. To change the structure, you have to heat it up to, what was it, 880 degrees Celsius?
Around that, yes.
Yeah.
This is austenitizing. You're turning the iron crystals into a phase called austenite. But here is the first big dilemma. Thermodynamics.
Okay.
When you heat steel that hot, the tiny grains that make up the metal, they want to merge. They want to grow larger.
And big grains are brittle.
Generally, yeah. You want fine grains for toughness. So how do you heat it up without ruining the grain size? This is where Romero points to the magic dust in the alloy. Aluminum nitride.
This is the pinning effect, right?
Think of it this way. Imagine you have a bunch of balloons trying to float away. Those are your grains trying to grow.
Uh-huh.
Aluminum nitride precipitates are like little tiny weights tied to the strings. They pin the boundaries of the grain so they physically can't expand.
So even at 880 degrees, these tiny chemical particles are just holding the structure together.
Precisely. But the chemistry has to be perfect.
Yeah.
If you don't have enough aluminum, the pins fail, and the grains just explode in size. It's this delicate balance that lets the manufacturer heat the steel enough to reset the structure without destroying the grain size.
Okay, so we've heated it, we've pinned the grains. Now comes the drama, quenching.
Mm-hmm.
You take this 900-ton glowing red ring, and you plunge it into water.
This is the most violent change. Mm-hmm. You are freezing the microstructure to trap it in a hard state. Usually you're aiming for a structure called bainite or martensite.
And the rule of thumb I've always heard in engineering is faster is better.
Right.
If you cool it slow, the atoms have time to rearrange into soft, weak structures, so you want to shock it.
That is the standard rule.
Right.
But Romero found a trap there, a really specific, dangerous trap called coalesced martensite.
Coalesced martensite, that sounds bad.
It is not good.
Yeah.
Romero found that if you cool it too fast, we're talking around 10 degrees per second, the martensite crystals, which usually form this nice, chaotic, interlocking weave, well, they start to align. They merge into these large, blocky platelets.
And just like with the grains, big blocks are bad.
Big blocks crack. They act as initiation sites for failure. So paradoxically, cooling the surface of the vessel too quickly can actually make it less tough.
Wow.
It's because of this coalesced structure. It's a nuance that empirical trial and error might completely miss, but the quantitative analysis, it spots it immediately.
So sometimes fast is too fast.
It's a very counterintuitive finding, yeah.
But here's the reality check the thesis brings up. We're talking about a wall of steel that is 30 centimeters thick, a foot of solid steel.
Yeah.
The surface hits the water and cools instantly. But the center...
The center is insulated by all that hot metal around it. It cools incredibly slowly. About 0.2 degrees per second.
So while the outside is risking this coalesced martensite from cooling too fast, the inside is barely cooling at all. Doesn't that just turn the center into mush?
Well, it turns it into electriomorphic ferrite, which is softer, yes.
Yeah.
And traditionally, metallurgists really worry about this.
Okay.
But Romero's work offered some reassurance here. He found that having this softer structure in the core wasn't a deal breaker for the overall safety, provided... And this is the callback.
Let me guess. The aluminum nitride.
That the initial grain size was kept small by those aluminum nitride pins we talked about.
It's all connected. You can't fix the cooling problem if you didn't get the heating chemistry right in the first place.
Exactly. It's a chain of custody for the atoms. If the aluminum nitride holds the line during the heating, then the slow cooling in the center is. It's manageable.
Okay, so now the vessel is hard, but it's stressed out. It's brittle from the quench, so we need to relax it. This is tempering.
The Goldilocks zone. You reheat it to about 640 degrees. You're sacrificing a little bit of that extreme strength to gain ductility.
The ability to stretch without snapping.
Exactly. And this is where the chemistry set comes out again. Now we're talking molybdenum and carbon.
Molybdenum carbide, or Mo2C.
That's it. During tempering, the molybdenum and carbon atoms, they sort of wander through the metal, find each other, and form these tiny needle-shaped precipitates inside the crystals.
I visualize these as tiny little rebar rods inside of concrete.
That's a great analogy. They reinforce the crystal lattice. They stop the layers of the crystal from sliding over each other too easily. But again, there's a danger. Over-tempering.
Leaving it in the oven for too long.
Yeah. Yep. If you hold it at temperature too long, those fine little needles start to grow. They lose their shape and they turn into coarse spheres.
And let me guess, big spheres are bad.
You're seeing the pattern. Big particles are crack starters.
Right.
The industry uses something called the Larson-Miller parameter to track this. It's like a mathematical formula for roasting a turkey. But Romero's thesis challenges the standard practice. He suggests the industry might actually be overcooking the steel.
Really? So the standard procedure is hurting the product.
His data showed that shorter tempering times actually improved everything. Hardness, strength, and toughness.
All three.
By pulling the steel out sooner, you keep those carbide needles fine and sharp rather than letting them grow into clumps.
That's a massive insight. Not only do you get a better vessel, but you save energy by running the furnace for less time.
It's a win-win, but it requires the confidence to change a recipe that's been used for decades. And that confidence, it only comes from the kind of quantitative proof this thesis provides.
We have to talk about the final boss battle, though. The Achilles heel of the whole process.
Welding.
You take this perfectly heat-treated ring, and then you melt it to stick it to another ring.
And you create the HAZ, the heat-affected zone. You are essentially ruining that carefully crafted microstructure right next to the weld.
So how do they fix it?
Post-weld heat treatment. They bake the entire finished vessel again at 600 degrees for 30 hours or more. It relieves the stress.
30 hours.
But this brings us to what I call the ghosts of the 70s.
This was the part about clean steel. I was surprised to learn how different steel is today compared to 50 years ago.
Oh, it's night and day. Mm. If you look at reactor vessels from the 1970s, the steel was, well, it was dirty. It had higher levels of sulfur, phosphorus, copper.
And why does that matter during this final bake?
Because of a phenomenon called temper embrittlement. When the steel is hot, impurities like phosphorus, they love to migrate.
Oh, no.
They drift to the grain boundaries, the edges of the crystals. They just sit there and they weaken the glue holding the crystals together.
So 20 years down the line, your vessel could be brittle because some phosphorus just drifted into the wrong spot during that final bake.
That's it, exactly. And that's why the J factor is so important. It's an equation mentioned in the thesis that predicts this risk based on the composition of manganese, silicon, phosphorus, and tin.
I see.
Rodern steel uses vacuum carbon deoxidation to literally suck these impurities out of the molten metal before it's even cast.
So modern steel is just significantly more resistant to aging than the stuff that's currently running in these older plants.
It is. The thesis really emphasizes that with modern SA508 grade 3, kept clean and heat treated correctly, the safety margins are much, much wider than we previously thought. We aren't just guessing anymore.
Which brings us right back to the core mission here, the 60-year lifespan. It seems like Romero's work is using new tools to validate this. He didn't just look at micrographs, he used neural networks.
That was the most forward-looking part of the thesis, funny. Metallurgy has so many variables, temperature, time, cooling rate, chemical composition. It's just hard for human brain to see the pattern across five dimensions.
Right.
Romero used AI to model these relationships.
So he could predict, if I lower the tempering time by 2 hours and increase the aluminum by 0.01%, what happens to the toughness?
Exactly. It allows us to design the next generation of alloys virtually, rather than melting 500 tons of steel just to see what happens. It helps predict safety margins on unseen data.
It's just amazing to think about. We usually look at a nuclear plant and we see these, you know, concrete domes, cooling towers, massive infrastructure.
Huge static things.
But the thing that actually determines if it's safe
is a microscopic battle.
Yeah.
It's about whether a molybdenum carbide precipitate stays a needle or grows into a sphere. It's about whether the martensite crystals merge or if they stay separate.
The integrity of a 900-ton structure depends on the behavior of atoms.
That's the reality of material science. The macro is defined by the micro. And frankly, this thesis shows that for a long time, we were doing the right things for reasons we didn't fully understand. Now we're starting to understand the reasons.
It really makes you wonder what other invisible ticking clocks are hiding in the infrastructure all around us. You know, bridges, skyscrapers, airplanes, they're all just collections of crystals holding on for dear life against entropy.
And as long as we understand those crystals, as long as we move from that empirical guessing to quantitative knowing, we can keep them holding on a little longer.
A fascinating look into the steel heart of the reactor. Thanks for unpacking it with me.
My pleasure.
And thank you for listening to The Deep Dive. We'll catch you on the next one.